Okay, that was a very short snippet of Bow Wow Wow for you on the 80s Underground. Second hour of the show getting underway here, and as promised, if all is well in the universe, I can hear the volume coming up. We should have Murray Attaway on the phone with us, calling all the way from the beautiful state of Georgia. Murray, are you there?
I am here.
Beautiful. Technology works here on a scrappy college radio station. Well, for those of you tuning in, you're listening to the 80s Underground Show. We're very pleased to have on the air with us right now Murray Attaway of the great 80s band Guadalcanal Diary, calling up today. Thanks for we're hoping to get you on a couple weeks ago. Fell through the cracks, but I appreciate you calling in today, Murray. And
it is my pleasure, Jeff.
Hey, well, I'm gonna start off my line of questioning with a little fanboy gushing here. I have to say, Guadalcanal Diary holds a special place in my heart because I was in high school back in it was about 1987 or so when I first heard you guys, and you had been around for a few years at that point, but to my naive ears, I didn't hear you until 1987, and right before your 2x4 album came out, the single Litany was on the radio a lot, and for some reason, that song threw me for a loop, and I was hooked ever since, and there's something about that track. It just really spoke to me in a special way, and it kind of shaped how I looked at music from that point on. And this was, you know, from a kid in a little beach town in Southern California, and here you are on the other side of the country in Georgia. Is it odd to hear those kind of stories, you know, after all these years, how your music kind of just snuck out there and touched people in interesting ways? I mean, so many years ago, and
it's not odd. It's just very, very gratifying. You know, I mean, you do hear it. It's always kind of surprising, but no, it's, I couldn't be more pleased when I hear things like that. That's very kind of you.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate it. And, you guys, you were around for a pretty short period in the mid to late 80s, but you put out a great body of work. And, I know there's, you still have a pretty sizable fan base. Are you, did you think that your legacy as a band would kind of carry on some 30, 25, 30 years later and, you know, still be moving forward?
You know, you don't think about that. I mean, that's not what you think about when you're doing it. You just sort of go out and do it and try to make the music that you like, that you think hopefully somebody else is going to like it and, you know, hear it and it's going to mean something to them. But you know, I don't know if other people thought that way. I know that nobody in Guadalcanal, we never sat around and talked about, oh, you know, 30 years from now, people are going to be doing this. You know, it's just not the way it happens with people like us.
Yeah.
Again, I can't speak for any other band, but no, with Guadal, it's just like we were just trying to do the best we could every day back then. So the legacy was not ever a part of the sort of agenda.
Yeah. Well, I can imagine. I mean, there was a huge crop of bands at that time. I mean, it was kind of the explosion of college radio and underground music, and you know, like you said, I'm sure other bands probably say the same thing. They were thinking they were part of some sort of wave of special music, but I think it's really cool that, and then, you know, the music speaks for itself and it has a good shelf life and it still sounds, I mean, that song and most of the stuff from your repertoire sounds as fresh today as it did 25, 30 years ago, at least to my ears. And that's the beauty of music, the beauty of good music like that, at least.
That's one of the best things you could say to me, is that it doesn't sound dated. That's great.
And it doesn't. And I'm in all honesty, I mean, you know, there's tons of stuff from the 80s that sounds dated and not necessarily in a bad way, but when it can sort of just be fresh and sort of timeless, that's always a bar higher, at least in my book.
I like the stuff that ends up sounding dated. I shouldn't say dated, but it ends up sounding like totally identifiable from the 80s. I have like playlists of tons of sort of Brit techno stuff that I listen to, you know, that sounds that way to my ear. And it's really fun to listen to it that way. Like back in those days, I never really listened to Tears for Fears very much, but I listened to them a lot now. You know? Because the stuff really stood up, but it also has that real definable 80s sound.
Sure, yeah.
And they were good songwriters. I guess they still are good songwriters. I don't know them. So.
Yeah.
Well, stuff like that. But yeah, I'm glad Guadal doesn't sound that way in a way, because our whole thing was always just to do, like I said, just to do as well, to make music that we liked.
Right.
You know, and hopefully everybody else could like it. But
Well, tell us a little bit about your history. I mean, I'm kind of vaguely familiar. I know from the start you guys weren't necessarily part of the Athens scene, because I believe you were based in, was it Marietta, sort of outside of Atlanta?
Yeah.
How did you guys get your start and get going?
Well, let's see. Jeff and I had known each other like throughout high school, and Jeff was kind of like the local guitar hero guy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he was always in bands, and he was the guy that had the gear. Like, he had a basement in his house, his right. parents' house, and, you know, a reel-to-reel recording, a tape deck, and, you know, guitars and amps and drums and all this kind of stuff. And he was always the guy that was in and out of all these different little bands. And he and I started messing around simply because most people in our neighborhood in those days nobody sang. It's like everybody wanted to be a guitar player, a drummer, a bass player, but nobody would sing. Well, I was a lousy singer, but I didn't care, you know. So I was like, I'll come sing on this, you know. Let's do one of your songs and I'll sing. It sucked, you know. It's terrible, but I would do it. And we made all these tapes in his basement, and I'd love to listen to some of them again. They were like real prog rock kind of stuff, because we were both into Tull and all this, you know, back then. And Rhett was another friend that we both knew, you know, from school, and mm-hmm. she wanted to learn how to play bass, and so Jeff basically taught her how to play bass. John was a guy who was from another place, another part of Georgia, in Atlanta, and he was just like this phenomenal drummer, but he didn't want to play drums anymore. He wanted to play guitar, bass, you mm-hmm. know, front of band, whatever. So we talked. Jeff had been in a band with him. I was like, man, if we could write these songs and put this band together, if we could get that guy to play drums, we'd have something. Mm-hmm. He's like, yeah, I don't want to play drums anymore, but, you know, we'll see. Let's see what we can do. So we talked him into being our temporary drummer till we could find another drummer. And that's how Guadalcanal basically came together. Jeff and I wrote songs. We got the two of, you know, Rhett and John in the band like that, and that's where it went.
Isn't that kind of how Keith Moon got his start? I sort of vaguely remember, like, he was they were looking for a drummer. They said, oh, you'll do for now or something, and he never was officially part of the Who. I don't know.
Yeah,
I heard some
yeah,
running joke about that.
I heard that, too. And John himself will tell you that he still thinks of himself as a temporary drummer of Guadalcanal Bowery after 30 years. So.
Yeah. Well, you guys, you had the magical combination, I think. I mean, he's a phenomenal drummer and definitely adds a certain style to a lot of your songs. So that's cool. So was this like in the probably, what, early 80s that you started getting together before?
It was 81.
81. And then was it 83 when was it the Watusi Rodeo EP
yeah,
or whatever came out?
I think it was 83 when that EP, I'm surprised you didn't know about that.
I'm good with deers.
When that EP came out, we were kind of like, we sort of didn't want to do it, you know. But anyway, this friend of ours had started this little record label and kind of just kept pushing us. We did it, but we kind of figured we were already going to make an album, because there was this guy in Atlanta named Danny Beard who owns a record store, literally a record store that has been there, I don't know how long it's been there, 40 years, maybe something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But he had started a label called DB Rex, and they had put out all this really good stuff. Like, they put out Pylon and, mm-hmm. you know, a bunch of bands you might not have ever heard of, like Method Actors. They put out Swim Pool Cues.
Oh, yeah, I'm like familiar that. With those.
And, you know, that was the cool indie label. Mm-hmm. And we pretty much figured we'd end up doing that, and we did end up doing that, but at first that's why we kind of didn't want to do the 4-song EP. It was just kind of like, yeah, let's wait around, we'll wait and see. Guado was big on waiting on stuff. You know,
yeah,
we're very unlike a lot of other bands. We're like, oh, we gotta get in the studio tomorrow. I was like, no, we don't need to do that, just hang out and see. Our big thing was our big goal in those days, there was a club in Atlanta called the 688 that everybody played. It was a really great club run by a great guy named Steve May. And we wanted to headline the 688 Club on a Friday night. That was our goal. We had no goal beyond that. You know,
right.
It was like, if we can play this hip club, headline, so get good enough to headline on a Friday night and bring all these people in, then we've kind of done what we're here to do, you know?
Yep.
And people would ask me that over the years, like, well, are you sorry that you didn't get, like, real rich like R.E.M. did? Well, it's always the R.E.M. question. Aren't you sorry you didn't? It's like, we weren't even thinking about that, you know? I mean, we thought we were doing pretty good by packing 688 on Friday night.
Yeah, you know? Well, and it's not like R.E.M. was a huge band either in 1984, you know. They were up and coming, but I wouldn't say they were, you know, like a dominant band on the, you know.
No. At least in our remember. I mean, after that,
yeah.
Years later, sure. I would always get those questions. Yeah. Aren't you sorry that you didn't, you know, because people always want to poke holes and stuff. And say, isn't it too bad that you didn't do this and you didn't do it? Well, sure. Yeah, I mean, sure, I wish I'd had, like, some ginormous bank account from some song I'd written.
Right.
But that's not what you were doing. You weren't
sure.
Thinking about it, you know? I don't regret any of it. I think we did pretty well for what we did. So.
Yeah. No, I couldn't agree more.
And most of the people that I know from that period that were, you know, active musicians in that period, like Peter Hallzapfel and people like that, they're friends of mine, feel more or less the same way. You know, that's we were just out there doing it. And we weren't thinking about, oh, well, yeah, maybe. Maybe. I mean, you do think about, you know, gosh, it'd be great to have a huge hit.
Right.
But we did have hits. They were college radio hits.
Sure.
And that was a cool thing. So.
Yeah, well,
I'm proud of our legacy, I guess, is what I'm saying. I'm sort of rambling here, so stop me.
No, it's great. It's great to hear all these all the details and you know, of everything of how you got up and coming and you know, as far as the outreach, I mean, you got far enough to get on the radio in Southern California and strike my ears back in '87. So you know, that speaks to something definitely. And
yeah, you know, and that's great. Yeah. I mean, that's all that matters. I mean, I've still got people from all over the planet, literally, you know, contacting me and asking me stuff about Guadalcanal.
Yeah.
That actually hasn't existed,
yeah.
You know, in any meaningful sense for, you know, 20-something years. So, yeah.
So, okay, so you guys all, you got together, you did the Watusi EP, recorded, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, you recorded your first official album, The Walking in the Shadow LP, released it independently, and then subsequently got picked up by Elektra, correct? And
that's right. When we signed with Elektra, that we insisted that was part of our signing deal, was that they re-release it, because we didn't feel that DB Rex had, not that they wouldn't have, they just weren't able to, in those days, promote it the way we felt that it should have been promoted. We thought it was a good album.
Yeah.
So we wanted it to get all over the planet, you know, and DB Rex couldn't quite do that. They did a good job with it, but not quite what we were looking for. So Elektra didn't want to re-release it. They were like, no, you got to make a brand new album for us. And we're like, that's fine. We don't have to do that. We can see another example of Guadalcanal waiting. You know, we had these other labels after us. We were like, well, you know, if you don't want to do this, that's fine. We're sure Capitol will do it, you know, or Geffen will do it or whatever. And so they said, okay, we'll do it. And they did a good job with distributing it and promoting it. I was very happy about that.
Did you have other interests from other big labels or?
Yeah. It was funny because, you know, the way the music business worked in those days was what everybody hoped for was that you get out, you play, maybe you put out an indie record, and then you start to get all the big boys come sniffing around. And that really happened to us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they'd follow us on tour, and so we'd be playing these little clubs all over North America. And, you know, here would be this guy from Geffen, or here would be somebody from Capitol, or here would be somebody from, you know, I don't even know, Elektra, of course, and then all the labels that existed back then. It was really kind of fun. You got a lot of free dinners that way.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
So you ultimately, what was the decision? What was the reason to go with Elektra? Was it because they let you put out the record as is, as your first album?
Yeah, because they pretty much agreed to all our conditions. They gave us a good deal as far as percentages go,
mm-hmm.
which was very rare in those days, unless you were Prince or Madonna. Like, to be able to get the percentage that we got was kind of unheard of for a band like us, so they agreed to that too. But mainly, we really liked the guy that signed us, a guy named Kevin Patrick, who I'm still friends with. And we really liked Electra's history. Those mm-hmm. kind of things really mattered to us, you know. So, I mean, you could look back and see, you know, the Jack Holzman years of Electra and just go, oh, my God, look at all this cool stuff they, you know, they issued. And it didn't even sell, but it was so cool they kept putting it out, you know.
Right.
And, they, and then every now and then they'd hit on something like the Doors, you know.
Right.
And this is like, wow. You know, they'd put out these Gene Ritchie folk albums and stuff, and then they'd put, you know, Morrison Hotel out. It was an interesting label.
Yeah. And they subsequently released all the records, correct? All the Guadalcanal records were on Elektra?
Yeah.
Is that right? Okay.
Yeah, except for the live one that we did in the 90s that was just on our little imprint.
Right.
Yep, they did all four of them.
You know, one thing I've always, just getting back to the music, one thing I've always been interested in and I've read tidbits about but never had much detail on is, you know, from a lyrical standpoint, a lot of your stuff deals with, you know, theology and religious themes. And I my understanding is that you have some background in that, but enlighten me and our listeners on exactly, you know, what that's all about. Because it definitely makes your music stand out and it makes it interesting from a lyrical standpoint. Do you,
well, what background is it that you've heard that I have?
Just that you had a background in theology. I didn't know if you were a minister, if you studied theology, if that was. Maybe I'm pulling something that I read wrong. I don't know, but I know the lyrical themes reflect that. And I'm just curious where that came about.
No, you're right. The lyrical themes reflect philosophy and spirituality.
Right.
And I have read that business about me being, you know, some sort of theologian. I've read that myself about myself, and just gone, oh dear God, you know, if you only knew me, you know, how funny this would seem. No, I have no kind of background like that.
Okay.
Whatsoever. It was just a lot of that stuff was that I can only speak for myself. I can't speak for Jeff because he wrote some things like that too. Mm-hmm. But for me, a lot of that stuff was just my way of sort of trying to get my own spiritual worldview into a song.
Okay.
And mostly doing it very clumsily. It's very easy to pick out imagery from something as remarkable as, say, like a Bible or a Quran or something like that. It's easy to steal that imagery
mm-hmm.
and then work with it. But it's even easier when you already sort of are thinking in those terms,
right.
You know, when this is really where you want to go with the song. And you're like, oh, look, and then we can say, why do the heathen rage? Because that's this really cool passage in the Bible. What does it mean? Well, I don't know. You know, nobody really seems to know. But guess what? When we put it in here, it will be vague enough that it will work with the rest of the lyrics, and people will make their own. It's amazing to me what people think that I wrote, you know?
Right.
It really is. I was telling a story to somebody recently, something that happened to me a long time ago. I was on a solo tour after Guadalcanal had ended, and I'd signed, you know, with Geffen as a solo artist.
Mm-hmm.
And I was doing this broadcast. It was like I was playing like a theater somewhere. I think it was Colorado Springs or something like that. And they made the tragic mistake of letting me have live airtime. There's this network called Rocky Mountain Radio or Rocky Mountain Network. Back then, I don't know what it was called. But anyway, it broadcast all through that whole Colorado area and, you know, every place around it. And they gave me all this live time. Like, are you people crazy? You know, I might actually curse and stuff. And they're like, no, you got it. So anyway, I'm doing this show, and I'm actually kind of getting down on Colorado about being anti-gay, because at that point in the early 90s, it had come out that they weren't real happy with gay folk. I mean, I'm not gay, but, you know,
right.
So what? I was giving them a hard time about it, saying, you know, I love Colorado, I want to move here, but you people don't like gay people. And they're like, oh, well, you know, come help us change all that kind of stuff. Anyway, so after the show, these two young women come up to me and start talking this, what sounds like babble to me. And I'm like, what? And they said, like, Ashi Nisha Hasek, some stuff. I mean, I can't even imitate because I don't know what it was. And finally, I was like, I don't know what you're saying. And they said, we're saying, you know, the peace of God be with you in the original Aramaic, just like Jesus would have said it. You should know this.
Oh, goodness.
I should know it.
Of course, yeah. I mean, God, doesn't everybody know that? Come on.
Well, they thought I would know it because they went on to say, well, we think it's so brave of you to express your Christianity so forthright in your songs the way you do. I'm like, oh, gosh.
Oh, no.
That's not what I'm doing. You know, but I didn't say, you can't say that. You know, you just kind of go, thank you very much.
Right, yes,
that
right.
was good, kind of you. So, anyway, well, I've heard that stuff.
Huh.
About myself, but it's pretty far from the truth.
Well, it's interesting to hear you say that, because you know, like you said, based on what people may have written and what you might interpret, they would interpret you as a religious person. I mean, were you at the time?
I'm a very spiritual person.
Right.
I like to you know, flatter myself that I'm very spiritual. I'm pretty much the same now as I was then, but I wouldn't ever have tagged it with like one faith or one. One dogma, nothing like that, you know?
Interesting. Yeah, well, I appreciate the clarification that...
well, I hope it doesn't offend you or anything.
No, it doesn't offend me at all. It actually makes it, you know, more... It makes sense, and it, I think, points to a certain, you know, level of interest and creativity, you know, as far as lyrics, because, you know, anybody can write a song about a guy getting a girl and having your heart broken, but, you know, I think you wove some interesting themes into your songs that made them stand out in a way that others didn't. And
well, thank you.
Yeah, you know, I guess the yeah. flip side of that is people may have thought you were like a minister or something, but, you know.
I never minded it. It was just always weird to me.
Yeah.
It's like, where did you get it? I mean, I knew where they got it, but it's like to take that – to take something out of a song and just run that far with it,
right,
you know,
right,
and say, well, because this guy says blah blah in the song, then he must be. In fact, one time I did an interview years ago, where this woman told me that she was afraid to interview me because she had been told I was going to preach to her. I'm like, what? That's really not what you have. To worry about. If you're going to worry about something, that's not one of the things you have to worry about with me. I'm not going to preach to you. There are other things you could worry about, but that's not one of them. You know?
Oh, man. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, that's crazy. You know?
Well, you know, just I'm kind of sort of going chronologically here. You know, another thing, I have a couple other little tidbits I want to share with you. Actually, I think I even posted this on your Facebook page, but I was actually for a brief period part of the Guadalcanal Diary fan club, and I still have an autographed picture from you guys. I have the typewritten letter. It was probably done on like an IBM typewriter.
Oh, sure. If it was done on an IBM typewriter, it might have been done on a Royal.
Something. It was pre-computer, but I still have the letter. You know, welcome to the fan club. It had the button attached to it, but I love the photo, which I still have. I think I scanned and sent it to you.
Yeah.
But before I move on to my next question, I have another fascinating tidbit I got to share with you. I think as part of the fan club, I even paid for a T-shirt, a Jamboree T-shirt, which sadly I wore it so much I can't wear it anymore because it's in tatters. But
oh, good! I thought you were going to say you never got it. How can I fix this?
I got it. I think I wore it every. Just about every day of my senior year in high school. But anyway, I was on vacation. It was summer.
You were quite the nerd, weren't you?
I was. And everyone's like, you know, oh, cool, Guadalcanal, cool shirt. I think I got more compliments on the shirt because it was a cool design, but not everybody knew who the band was. So I had to explain. Yeah. It's a band. But this is fascinating.
So that's what makes digging indie music cool, is because not everybody knows it. So you get to go, oh, well, you don't know about this. Let me just tell you.
Well, that, and it was an awesome shirt because it was the album cover from Jamboree. So anyway, I'm on vacation, summer of '88. I'm with my dad, and we're in Calgary, Canada. They have an annual rodeo up there called the Stampede. It's like a big deal. And
I'm fully aware of the Stampede.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm trying to remember exactly where it was. I think we were we were at a hotel, and we were maybe taking a shuttle from the hotel to the rodeo or something, and we're sitting on a bus, and there's this old couple sitting across from me, and I'm wearing my Jamboree Guadalcanal Diary T-shirt, and this woman's like, "Oh, we know those guys. They practiced in our basement or something to that effect. And we're from Marietta, Georgia, and I don't remember their name, their first names, but the last name was Cheney, I believe, as in Dick Cheney. Although I hope they weren't related." But they said something to the effect of, "Oh yeah, we nice guys. You know, they practice and they had the Georgia accent. They're like, yeah, I think they practice in our basement or down the street or something." Do you know an older couple with the last name Cheney?
No, now, but for that kind of stuff, you're kind of talking to the wrong guy. Jeff is sort of the one that's got all that in his brain. He can tell you what day and what year we played at what club in, you know, Winnipeg. I mean, he can tell you that stuff. I can't. But I don't remember anybody named Cheney that would have been, that would have said, you know, they practice in a basement. Now, it could have been that we practiced in the basement of a house that Jeff rented, and maybe they were the owners of the house.
Maybe. It was something to that effect. And again, this was a while ago, and they obviously knew you, and they saw my shirt, and they didn't say, oh, I read that book. They said, oh, I know that band. Mm. And it was an older couple. You know, they're probably like at the time, you know, in their 60s, maybe 70s.
That's probably who it was. It was probably the landlords of the place Jeff rented.
Yeah.
That's pretty weird, though. I mean, and you saw him at the Calgary Stampede of all things.
Yeah, Calgary, Canada, and this was in 1988. And I just, that was a really fun story.
The reason I know about Canada as much as I do is because my ex-wife is Canadian. Mm. And we're still real good friends, just, you know, not married anymore. But, yes, I'm a real, you know, Canuckophile, sort of. I know a lot more about Canada than most Americans do. For instance, I'm a big Stompin' Tom fan and was very sorry when he died.
Did you guys play a lot of shows in Canada? I mean, during the Guadalcanal years?
Guadalcanal did, and then I played a lot more solo stuff in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And Canadian audiences were always just great. And but I love Canada. It's a great country. Love the city. Don't care that much about the prairies.
Right.
But, you know, like Toronto, Vancouver, Quebec, places like that, great, great cities. Toronto, not so much right now. They need to get rid of that mayor. But
Yeah, he's it's like
it's
a
like, I can't even believe that guy's Canadian. You know, he doesn't even seem like a Canadian. I thought he was from Texas or something.
Yeah, he kind of puts a weird spin on what I think everyone's preconception of Canadians are, and not necessarily in a good way. But
yeah, and obviously Canadians aren't really like you think they are. You know, they're just like
everybody else.
They're
right?
Like us, but they do have a tendency to be a little bit more low key, and they do have a tendency to be a little bit more polite than most Americans. And that guy, he's not wearing that at all. Anyway, sorry to get off on that.
No, I totally agree. So those are my Guadalcanal tidbits. But moving chronologically, and by the way, for those of you just tuning in, this is the 80s Underground Show. We're talking with Murray Attaway of Guadalcanal Diary. I always forget to do that because people are scratching their heads for 10 minutes. Who's he talking to? So, you know, one thing I was always curious about and I never really saw much about was, I mean, you guys were around for, I guess, a relatively short period. Not super short, but, you know, compared to some bands. Yeah. What was the ultimate, you know, demise of the band? You guys did four albums on Elektra in 1989 was the flip-flop, the last record, and then you guys called it quits. What was, what's the story behind that?
It was kind of biological in a lot of ways. We had done a lot of touring. Together, we had, you know, gone from, you know, four of us plus a couple of crew members in a tiny little van going all around North America to better touring stuff. You know, all sleeping in not even a hotel room, somebody's house, you know, somebody's room that would let us all crash there to better circumstances. But nonetheless, still for 8 years, just doing pretty much the same thing.
Right.
Rhett and Jeff had gotten married and had a baby, and they had that baby. Her name's Lily. She's not a baby anymore. She's in her 20s now, but they took her along on tour.
I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, on that last tour, the flip-flop tour.
Wow.
And they hired this really wonderful woman who unfortunately passed away suddenly a couple of years ago, but really cool woman to be the nanny. But anyway, not to get too far into this, because I mean I can talk about this stuff for hours. You got to be careful with me.
Right.
But what happened basically is that at the end of that tour, it was really hard on us for some reason, I mean, besides it being hard on Jeff and Rhett and their baby, and that circumstance, it was just kind of hard on all of us. We weren't really happy with the way the record was being distributed. Jeff and Rhett really didn't want to make that record. They wanted to wait. They wanted to take a year off, which maybe we should have done. John and I wanted to make the record, which was actually kind of cool because that record had a bunch of songs that John wrote.
Yeah, I recall that.
And they're good songs for the most part, you know. And we never had any record with a bunch of his material on it before. So we were... We didn't feel like the record was distributed properly or promoted properly. We're just worn out, you know?
Yeah.
We were tired of the whole thing. And I also had people from other record labels whispering in my ear, oh, come on, you know, when you get ready to go solo, you call us, you know, let us know, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I was thinking, and I was just dumb enough and still young enough to think, this could be fun. And I could make all the decisions myself, and I wouldn't have to worry about this. But that's basically what happened, is we just got burnt out on it.
Yeah.
And the one thing that I'm sorry about is that Jeff, in his wisdom, wanted us to take a year off and then reconvene. And Rhett didn't want to do that. She wanted to go be a full-time mom, which I totally get it, because that's why I quit music, too, to be a full-time dad. John was ready to quit, too, and I had, you know, these other labels sort of going, hey, come here, hey, you know. So that's how it happened. I wish we had listened to Jeff, and I wish we'd just taken a year off, because if we had of, we would have made at least one more Guadalcanal Diary album, and it would probably have been the most interesting one that we've made, you know.
Yeah.
But the other side of that coin is that right when that happened, that's when Nirvana exploded.
Okay, right. Yep.
And you had all of that happening. I'm pretty sure Nirvana opened for us in somewhere in the Pacific Northwest at some point. They were just, at first, they were just that kind of band. They sounded like every college radio. I mean, they sounded like every band that ever opened for us.
Right.
You know? There was nothing that unusual about them until you took a closer look. Then once you did, you were just like, oh, my God, okay, this is really something here. But that happened, and a lot of the bands that were from our era as such that were the college radio mainstays, those bands fell by the wayside. Even the ones that kept going, they couldn't kind of get any more traction because now everybody was looking for not as in the public, but like record labels and people like that were looking for bands that, you know, knit wool caps, you know, toboggans and flannel shirts.
Yeah, I realized Nirvana changed the landscape of music when I was in college, and the local metal band, who had been a metal band for years, all of a sudden in like early 92 covered Smells Like Teen Spirit in their set.
Right.
That's when the local metal band covers Nirvana. I knew, like, okay, that's the end of that.
I got in big trouble one time. I was doing a panel. This was after Guadalcanal broke up, but I was doing a panel at a music seminar, which is like one of the stupidest, dumbest things you can possibly have is a music seminar. But anyway, they had it. So I'm on this panel. I don't even remember what the theme of the whole thing was, but I do remember that what I said when they got to me, I was like, you know, if you're a band starting out and you're trying to get a record deal, don't pay attention to what these record labels think you should be, because all they're doing is running up to Seattle looking for people wearing flannel shirts.
Yep.
And there were people in the audience that were also on the panel that were from record labels that were so angry about it. They're like, we're not doing that. We're not doing that. He doesn't know what he's talking about. It's like, yeah, I did know what I was talking about too, bud.
Just watch the movie Hype. That'll put that all to rest. I kind of forgot about the whole Nirvana phenomenon sort of coinciding around that time. And
it happened right at the end of our career.
Yeah. But you subsequently, I mean, you reemerged, was it about 93, I think, with your first solo record, and that was with Geffen?
Yeah, I signed with Geffen in 1990, and I wrote the entire record plus another record's worth of songs. This is how it worked with those guys. I wrote all that record within 6 months of signing with them.
Oh, really?
But they weren't ready. Yes, they were not ready.
Okay.
And I thought, wait a minute, I'm making the record. I'm ready. And they're like, well, we're not ready.
So it actually sat for a couple of years before they put it out, huh?
Oh, no, we didn't even make it.
Oh, you
just
had
all these songs. Oh. I had all these demos and stuff like that, and we didn't even make it. They just kept putting me, you know, no, the time's not right.
Right.
And the guy that signed me kept quoting that stupid, I don't know if you remember this, remember the Paul Masson wine commercial? We will serve no wine before it's time.
Right, right.
He kept quoting that to me. And I'm not going to curse here. I want to, but, you know, it's like, what do you mean before it's time? I'm ready. I wrote these songs. Now, let's do it now, you know.
So what ultimately decided that it was the right time? What was the factor there?
Who knows?
Something arbitrary?
Yeah, something arbitrary. The planets lined up. I mean, who knows?
Yeah.
But, I mean, it also took me a year to make that record, and I was, like, used to making records in about a month.
Yeah.
So it's like, I mean, I like that record. I think there's some good stuff on it, but man, it was a good experience. I mean, I'll never, ever, you know, regret that experience of just like totally immersing myself in the whole LA, you know, recording scene at that period. It was great because I got to work with people that I would have never worked with, got to be friends with people I would have never known otherwise. You know, I met some really cool people, but by the second record that I was supposed to do with them, I was like, I'm making this record in North Carolina at the studio I like to record with,
right,
with my friends that know what's going on, you know, with these kind of songs and this kind of music, and the producer that, you know, produced 3 of the 4 Guadalcanal albums and all this, and they didn't like that at all, so it never came out.
Oh, so this was that you had a second record that never officially came out?
I have 2 records that never came out.
Really?
It can be told, Fab listeners.
What's happening with that music? Was it ever? Did you ever reissue it independently? Or
nope. I could never get the rights to it.
Wow. So you're referring to after the first Geffen record you recorded? I'm presuming you mean with Don Dixon. Is that who you recorded with?
Yeah, I did 2 albums worth of music with Don Dixon. Yeah, after that.
And that music's done and finished, but it's not out there.
If you ask Don, he will tell you to this day it is not finished, only because he and I see it differently. If you ask me, I'll tell you, oh, hell yeah, it's finished.
Yeah.
You know, but Don's a real perfectionist, and there was some fairy dust he wanted to sprinkle on it that he didn't get to. I mean, what happened was they basically rejected the album.
This was Geffen?
Goofin? I never heard that before. That's appropriate. And they basically rejected it, and he and I were like, okay, have we got any money left in the budget? And we did, so we just kept recording.
Good for you. Milk it for all it's worth, you know?
We ended up with something like 23 songs.
So what's going to happen with that? I mean, are you going to get the rights back eventually? Or
I mean, it's been 20 years now. I mean, how can I, you know? No, I've gone through every channel I could possibly go through. You know, unless a miracle happens, no, I'll never be able to release those recordings. Now
you could re-record it, correct?
I can re-record it. Yeah, they're my songs. Right. I can re-record them, all, you know, all day long. But in fact, you may not know this, or you probably do. Jeff Walls and I put together a band called Bomber City.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah, a few years back, and it's kind of an on again, off again sort of thing, but for some weird reason, I never did understand this, but Jeff was like, I just want to be the side man in this band. You know, I'm really used to being a side man now because he's been in the Woggles for years. I'm like, whatever, dude. And he says, so let's just, you know, you pick all the songs and I'll just be the musical director. I'm like, okay. And we're going to do all your songs. I said, okay, let's do a bunch of weird covers too that we've never done. So we did some of those songs live, but we never recorded them because we just have never gotten around to it. I don't really know if Bomber City exists or not because it just kind of seems it's like what was that musical about the city that only shows up every 100 years?
Atlantis?
No, it's some goofy musical from the 50s about Brigadoon.
Okay.
We're like Brigadoon. It's like we may exist, but we may not, you know.
Yeah,
we
I
were
was
just
gonna...
talking yesterday. Do you know who Robert Schmidt is?
No. Sorry to say.
Okay, here's who he is. He was the original drummer from Swim Pool Cues.
Okay.
And now he is their bass player. But he's done, you know, a ton of stuff, obviously, in between. And one of the things that he did in between was he and I had a little combo that we played in together like a long, long time ago. After Guadal, and we loved playing with each other. It was just great fun. You know, it was like one of those things that really clicked, like me and Jeff Walls. You know, it's like it just clicked. It made sense. So he contacted me earlier this year, and he was all about, you know, let's do a project. So I think what you may see is you may see Bomber City actually reemerge as a four-piece. It was a six-piece, which was like nuts to me. That was like trying to, you know, handle an orchestra. I'm used to four pieces.
Right.
But we may reemerge with him as the drummer as a six-piece. I mean, as a four-piece. So
right.
We'll see. But anyway, that music got played. A lot of that stuff got played through that band. So it got out there to people's ears, but not, we never recorded. You know, so.
Now I know Guadalcanal Diary got back together for some reunion shows not too long ago. Are you?
Yeah, man.
Yeah, is there any talk or hint of the four of you original members of Guadalcanal getting back together and recording or playing? Or
I wish I had money for every time somebody asked me that.
The answer is
I
yes,
really
no,
do.
Maybe.
Yes, no, maybe.
Yeah.
I mean, I can never answer that.
Yeah.
I mean, I hope we do. Because I'll tell you, it's a really fun band to play with. And when we're good live, we're actually, in my opinion, as good as anybody live. It's just a fun band to get on stage with, and they're good songs, and everybody's enthusiastic and all that kind of stuff. I mean, yeah, it was really great doing those reunions a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But we got this one review. It was really funny. A lot of people got mad about it when it came out in the press, but I thought it was hilarious. It said, called us the aging but nimble band.
There's a backhanded compliment for you.
Yeah, that's like the start of the sentence. The aging but nimble band took the stage.
Oh, man.
That's exactly how you should call it. Aging but nimble.
Wow. There's more backhand than compliment in that, I think. But
yeah, it was a slap. But that's cool. But, you know, the guy that wrote it was like this big fan. It's just he had to note the fact that we weren't 25.
Yeah. Oh, jeez. Well, I hope the rest of it was a good review anyway.
Yeah, well, it was. It was a glowing review. The whole thing was like this, basically this almost a fanboy review, but, you know, just that one sentence. And I thought that sentence was great. A lot of other people were like, he should have never written that. Like, what are you talking about? It's actually true. I mean, why wouldn't he write it?
Well,
aging but nimble.
I have to say, I mean, speaking of live experiences, and I've been to a lot of shows in my time, but to this day, one of my favorite live shows was you guys. I saw you when I was a little fanboy back. I think I just started college. It was the fall of 88. Guadalcanal Diary played a little dump in Southern California called the Coach House.
Oh, I know the Coach House.
San Juan Capistrano.
Yeah. Sure. Sure, I know. But that's not a dump. I love playing that place.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. I sort of remember being.
I don't know what it is now. It was fun to play back then.
Yeah, but that was, to this day, was one of my favorite live show experiences. You guys played there, I think it was October 88. I drove all the way down from college and all the way back that night because I had class the next day, I think. But it was.
Wow.
I remember it was a place where they had tables that went right up to the stage.
Yep.
And I think it was it might have been the song 3 a.m. You came out and you were you were serenading all the ladies. I think you were even taking some drinks. You're picking up some drinks. And I'm like, man, that guy's got some balls. He's walking out on stage. You were walking down the tables, like, you know, kind of pushing chairs and picking up people's drinks and singing to the ladies. And I'm like, man, this is so awesome. And it was a great, great show. I remember it fondly.
Thank you. Thank you. Do you remember who opened for us at that show?
I don't. Honestly, I don't.
I wish I knew. But I bet Jeff knows.
But I remember seeing you guys, and that was the first time I think I might have been the first and only time I saw you, because it was like, well, the next year, I think you had after Flip Flop came out, you would stop. So,
well, you saw us at the height of our performing, because to me, 2x4 is the best record we ever did.
Oh yeah,
and
it's
when
my favorite.
Did that tour, you know, we were in all really in high spirits, and everybody was happy, and we loved the music we were playing, and you know, that record had done really well. So you saw us. If you were going to see Guadalcanal at all, that was like probably the best time to see us, unless you were crazy enough to have actually seen us the first time we played ever in the backyard of a friend's house who was having a wedding.
Yeah.
You know? And then there are people that like that are like, oh, I was there because, you know, it's historical and all this kind of stuff. I was like, yeah, and it sucked too, didn't it? No. It was great. It was great.
Yeah. There's always something about those really special shows.
Yeah. I'm the same way. I mean, I'm a fanboy too, believe me. Yeah. You know, the stuff like I was talking to a friend of mine the other night, talking about time travel, and I said, you know, I've always thought if I could time travel, if I had multiple destinations I could go to, one of them would be New York City in the 50s. So I could just walk into a club and hear somebody like Charlie Parker play, just casually, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, that early stuff, that's the coolest thing ever. But I guarantee you, most people, the first time you saw them, sucked. I mean, really sucked. And I've seen some, but I can claim some of that stuff. I mean, obviously, I have done it. I know we sucked the first time we played. But I saw the B-52s one of the first times they ever played. They played at a friend of mine's house in Athens on top of two picnic tables, and they were horrible. I mean, just horrible. Look, they couldn't play. I mean, they couldn't play anything, you know. But that was the whole Athens thing at that point. That's kind of what kicked it off. It's like, oh, we don't. What are these guitar things? We don't know what we're supposed to do with this. You know, that lasted. Boy, that lasted for years.
This goes back to when we first started talking. How you didn't really start in Athens, but I'm presuming you played there a lot, correct? I mean,
Athens was a tough nut to crack. And they didn't like us up here very much.
Was it because you weren't arty and weird enough and you didn't sound like Pylon?
That's exactly what. Now, remember, too, and you may not know this, but our bass player, Rhett, is the sister of Pylon's drummer, Curtis.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes, and Curtis and Jeff and I went to high school together, and Curtis is one of my oldest and dearest friends.
Oh, okay.
So there was a whole lot of, you know, whole lot of love between the two bands. We were just completely different. That was all. I mean, I love Pylon. They're like one of my favorite bands that ever drew a breath. You know, I love. In fact, when we did our reunion stuff, Randy Bewley, the guitar player, had tragically died so young, just like the year before that. So our encores were Pylon songs, just because we wanted to, you know, pay it back a little bit, but. I mean, Pylon was like, it still is one of my favorite bands there. But anyway, yeah, that was part of the deal, really, is that you had Pylon, who were just great, and everybody loved them around here. And you had the Bees, and the Bees were, you know, terrific, and they'd actually gone on to become famous. R.E.M. hadn't really done much yet, so that really wasn't happening so much. Mm-hmm. But the whole mood around Athens in those days was like, the way you put it, what did you say, arty and what?
Arty and weird.
Yeah, arty and weird is a good way to put it. And undisciplined.
Yeah.
And with no real musical knowledge.
Right.
And we came from this place where we wanted to walk out on a stage and be XTC.
Right.
You know, we knew how to play. We knew how to play our instruments. We actually knew how to write songs. We knew how to sing, sort of, and
right.
All that kind of stuff. I mean, we sounded like a rock band, and so they didn't care for that too much because, you know, it wasn't just like what we used to call mindless dance music. But see, if I say that at this point in history, it means a completely different thing than if I had said it in 1982 in Athens. Because back then, you had all these bands that really couldn't do anything. But, you know, the drummer could keep a beat, and the guitar player could go near, 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 whatever, and everybody would dance to it. And then we got on stage, and it was kind of like seeing those people thought of us sort of like you would think of a Led Zeppelin cover band, you know. they saw us and they were just like, oh, this is just old crap. You know, we don't want to do this. This is not what we're into. And we got it. We knew that was what was happening.
They stood in back with their arms folded.
Yep, they did.
Instead of pogoing around.
They did. Now, there were a couple of intrepid souls that would always jump out and dance, but it never caught on to us. But what we did is we kept playing. We kept playing and kept playing, and we would play anywhere up here. And finally it worked, you know, in Athens. I mean, yeah. we already had, you know, a lot of press, and we had an album out, you know, and it was popular on both sides of the Atlantic, all this kind of stuff. And Athens still didn't like us. It was like, good God, people, what do we got to do here? Finally, you know, we broke through. And it was Pylon that actually helped us. So.
Hmm. Well, that kind of makes sense the way you describe the approaches from those bands and how your approach was different. You know, that makes sense. And it all worked out because you got a record deal and you got your records out and played shows and lived the life for a few years at least.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. It was great. In a lot of ways, I still live the life. So, yeah.
Well, we're talking with Murray Attaway of Guadalcanal Diary here on the 80s Underground. We got to wrap it up here shortly, Murray, but I did have one question from one of my listeners. They actually were pressing me on this.
And
So it was a couple of, I guess about 10 years ago, was it 2003 that Elektra reissued the Walking in the Shadow, the Big Man and the Jamboree albums. Is there any talk of them reissuing 2x4 and Flip Flop?
I haven't heard of it. My understanding, wait a minute now, Elektra did this?
Well, I think so.
I thought it was Rhino.
Well, it was Collectibles, but it's marked as Elektra okay. Entertainment Group here.
Okay,
maybe
hold
it was
on.
A okay. subsidiary of Elektra.
Over the last 10 years, everything that we did except Flip Flop has been reissued, but has not necessarily been reissued in a good way.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Like somebody, and you know, I'm not going to bitch about this because I'm glad the music's out there, but somebody re-released, got the licensing and did it legally and re-released the first two albums, which I guess that's Big Man and Jamboree, on a 2/4 CD. And the problem with it is the sound is terrible on it. It doesn't sound like the originals. It's just crappy. It's really poorly done.
Huh.
But they got it out there. See, I didn't know about that when it happened. I didn't know about it until I actually saw it for sale.
Oh, geez.
I'm like, wow, okay. Here's, you know, the first two Guadal records crammed into one CD. And I got one. I actually bought one, you know, at Best Buy or something like that. And I brought it home. I was like, this is terrible. Why did they do this? You know, they redid the cover art that was just like this kind of generic, you know, eye stock image of a guitar and stuff like this. Like, oh, please. You know,
the Epiphone hollow body here or whatever.
yeah, that's the one I'm talking about. It's like, who did, do you know? I mean, you don't know anything about it.
I don't know. I don't claim to know that one.
Well, I'm not looking to hit anybody. I'm just saying, you know. So that was kind of embarrassing. But then a friend of mine named Scott Schender, who is a rock writer and has been for many years and a great guy, went to Rhino and basically worked out a plan with them to reissue these deluxe editions of the Guadal records. And so he got with me and Jeff on it, and he wrote liner notes, and then we gave him extra songs and all this kind of stuff. And they put out, I thought they put out Big Man and 2x4, I think. And those are the cool ones to have.
Okay.
And, I mean, they're cool to me, you know, like I've got them, you know, because that's one of my things. I wasn't getting paid for it, so I was like, okay, here's what you do. You have to send me a box of these things. And they did, and I think they're real cool. If you can find them, they're great to have. They've got these cool liner notes by Scott Schender, like I said, who knows way more about Guadal than I do. Mm. And then they've got all these extra songs that you would have never heard unless, you know, you've been around the band. I mean, stuff that we found that we dug up, you know, extra tracks and demos and stuff like that. They're just, you know, the cool Rhino-style releases. So those are the ones I know about. As far as anything else coming out, I don't know about it. No one tells me anything.
Nothing like being a slave to the man, right?
Well, you know, it's like they can do what they want.
Right.
You know, they're still on the mechanical with all this stuff. Nobody has to call me about this.
Right.
You know,
it would be nice if they did, though, right?
Yeah, it's nice when they do.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to call in. We're heading toward the top of the hour. I got to wrap up the show, but it's a treat to hear all the glorious history, and I appreciate you talking with us today. Murray Attaway of Guadalcanal Diary, talking on the 80s Underground. And let's do it again sometime if you're up for it. It's always cool to talk to people. I love relishing in the history. That's what this show's all about. So
I've got hours and hours of stuff I could just like ramble on about. So anytime you want to do it, Jeff, that's fine.
We'll do a part two. I really appreciate it. Thanks for calling, Murray. This is the 80s Underground on KSU. I'm going to finish with one of my favorite from the Walking in the Shadow album, Ghost on the Road.
Oh, yeah, I like this one.
Here we go. It's the 80s Underground.